Okay. All right. So we have a lot of things going on today. We have Parshas Truma, which is about the building of the Mishkan and the Kelim, mostly about the Kelim. We have Rosh Chodesh Adar. Mishenichnas Adar Marvin B'Simcha, that's going to be a big theme. Simcha, where does it come from? We have, at the same time that we celebrate the historical events of Purim, which are a glimpse into the Nisim of the end of days, the Nisim of Purim, although the Navi tells us that they're going to be greater than the Nisim of Yetzias Mitzrayim, they're of a completely different sort. And they're the sort of Nisim that we can expect at the end of days. And we'll speak about that. That relates also to the concept of building the Mishkan. And we also have to keep in mind that politically today, from the very same place, right, from Iran, is coming out the very same decree to annihilate every single Jew, man, woman, and child. Right? And as HaKadosh Baruch Hu did Nisim then, we are capable, it's within our own hands, to deserve those type of Nisim again, and those special type of Nisim, which we'll speak about. And Rav Moshe Shapira mentions that in the Megillah, you know, Ahasuerus sent out those letters at the advice of Haman to annihilate every Jew, and when Esther asked him to rescind those letters, to recall those letters, he answered that a letter that goes out signed with the seal of the king cannot be returned, recalled. Ein lahashiv. And what he says is that that what's really, the Megillah is really telling us, is that that decree that emanated from that place has not been recalled. And it still is emanating from that place throughout history. And we are seeing it again today. But the Nisim that they deserved because of their tshuva and their Kabbalah Satorah, again, their commitment to take upon themselves the Torah, we are also capable of that. How do these things come together, the Nisim of Purim and the Mikdash? Well, the Mikdash, as we know, is a place that existed in Eretz Yisrael. But it no longer exists. And that's accounted for in the very pasuk that gives us the command that tells us to build the Mishkan. It says, Va'asu li Mikdash, you shall build for me a Mikdash. You'll see it in the Parsha. I don't have the Chumash in front of me. It's what pasuk is it? It's a few psukim into the Parsha. Va'asu li Mikdash. V'shachanti v'socham. It's already accounted for. That, as the Ramban says, that the events of Har Sinai, which were momentary, were established by virtue of having the Mishkan in Klal Yisrael, in the midst of Klal Yisrael, a physical place. Those events of Har Sinai, that Giloy Shechina, that revelation, continued to be experienced by Klal Yisrael in a smaller scale through the Mishkan. That was the place of the Giloy Shechina, the continuation of Sinai. And when we no longer have a Mishkan, that revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu continues to be revealed through each and every person. Bilvavi Mishkan Evnen, with my heart I build my own Mishkan. So Vishachanti and I will dwell, Bitsocham, everyone knows this, within them they become the Mishkan. However, when a person thinks about being the dwelling place for the divine within themselves, it's sometimes brings a person who's honest to a state of perhaps confusion or hopelessness, in that a person wonders honestly how they can be a dwelling place for the divine. It's a very hard state of mind to maintain, a state of existence to maintain. It demands kedusha on many levels, of which we will speak about. Levels that are represented by the Kelim in the Beis HaMikdash. So when a person thinks about the reality of consistently being a dwelling place for the divine, they become perhaps disheartened, look around, look at people, look at the world, look at themselves. And yet the Torah tells us in this pasuk, in very specific language, it doesn't speak in a command, in a lashon tzivoy. It says it almost as a state of reality. Va'asu li mikdash, and they will build for me a mikdash. Vishachanti b'socham, and I will dwell within them. In other words, It is inevitable. Every single person will ultimately be a dwelling place for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. One way or the other. Those two ways are symbolized by one, the way of the Mikdash. Mikdash means, Va'asuli Mikdash, from the Shorish Kedusha, sanctification of life, represented by the three aspects, main aspects of life, represented by the three Kalim, which we'll speak about, the Shulchan, the Menorah, and the Mizbeach HaZahav, the golden Mizbeach for incense. Through properly orienting those three aspects of our lives and, in a sense, doing the avoda, the divine service through those aspects of our lives, we can elevate HaKadosh Baruch Hu and become a Mishkan, Va'asuli Mikdash. We will sanctify HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kodesh, Va'shachanti B'sochem, and then I, Hashem speaks in response, will dwell among them. There are two ways for this to happen. One is by way of the Mikdash, sanctifying our lives, the three basic areas of our life. The other way is by way of the story of Purim, the story of Adar, the story of the of Amalek, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, battle with Amalek. How do we know this is true, that there's two ways for a person to be a Mishkan? One is Amalek, as symbolized by the Nisim of Purim, and one is the Mikdash, because only two things, Chazal tell us, two realities, are described to us. And in their description, in their, when Hashem talks about them, He surrounds them by both of His names. We have, for example, in the Shira, Machon l'shiftecha pa'alta Hashem, a machon, a place, right? For you to dwell, you created Hashem. Mikdash ado, right? Konenu yadecha. So you have the word Mikdash surrounded by Hashem, and the name of Hashem, Adnus, right? Machon l'shiftecha pa'alta, a place for you to dwell, Hashem, you brought into existence. Pa'alta, you animated it. Hashem Mikdash Ado. That's the pasuk. Machon l'shiftecha pa'alta Hashem Mikdash Ado konanta yadecha. So the Mikdash is surrounded by the name of Yudke Vavke and the name of Adnus. Well, when we speak about nekama, revenge, which is always associated with Amalek, the ultimate evil, in Hodu, see it on Shabbos, says, Kel Nekamos Hashem. Kel is the name of Hashem, the name that represents Rachamim. It's not Elohim, it's Kel is a different name. Kel Nekamos Hashem, Yudke Vavke. So Gemara says, just like the Mikdash is surrounded by two names of Hashem, so is Nekama. So both ways, through the Mikdash or through Nekama, there will be a Giloy Shechina. Either way, there's no way to escape it. Either way, a person will become a Mikdash. A person is going to, through their proper behavior or their wickedness, they will become a way of sanctifying Hashem's name. Mikdash is Kodesh. And Hashem will dwell, will be revealed, will be seen to be present through that person. How does it work? First, we have to define Nekama, and this is, again, Rav Moshe Shapiro. How do we define Nekama? Nekama is not the following. Nekama is not when the liberators of the camps rounded up the guards and told the inmates, the prisoners, to do what they want. And all of their fury and all of their hatred could be unleashed against the perpetrators and they would rip them to shreds. That's not called Nekama. When the victim of the rishus, of the wicked, gets a chance to pay back the perpetrator. And also, by the way, if that scene was videoed, nobody would want to look at it a few years later and see what they did. Okay? It's not something we take pride in. And in fact, nekama is not something we participate in at all. Kel nekama sashem. Nekama is, like in the Haman story, nekama is when the rishus itself, the not just the plan to do bad, but the actual implementation is what destroys the perpetrator without the victim doing a thing. That was the case of Haman. He built the gallows. He hung on them. Mordechai had nothing to do with it. He came to Achashverosh in the middle of the night, says, asked to kill Mordechai just when Achashverosh was looking for a way to reward Mordechai, and he ended up dragging him around on the horse. Mordechai had nothing to do with it. He put Esther on the throne. Esther destroyed him, right? Esther didn't play a role there. It happened. That's how it worked out. Wasn't part of his decision to put her on the throne. In other words, when the desire to do wickedness, or, well, let's call it this, undermine Hashem's plan, violate everything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says is truth, that's what destroys the person. and we do nothing. We just watch it happen. That's called nekama, properly. It's Kel Nekamos Hashem. The name Kel is Rachmanos, and Yud Kei Vav Kei is Rachmanos, of different sorts. But it shows that evil itself, and you see that the greater power the evil has, the more it thinks that it expands, and it imagines that it is going to reach its goal and do what it's attempting to do, and the greater it gets, the greater the impact of the implosion when everybody watches and sees how it destroys itself. So that is an act of great chesed, because it's clarity. It's a giloy shechina. It means that the rishus evil, any way other than the way of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, just cannot exist. Period. It can't exist. It is not able to exist. In and of itself, it can't exist because it's sheker. That's a great giloy shechina. There's a way to reveal Hashem through our efforts, through what we call the mikdash, through establishing the basic areas of our life as represented by the Shulchan, Menorah, and Mizbeach HaKadosh properly, and thereby bring a sanctification to God's name. But make no mistake about it. If a person goes completely in the other direction, gets lost in the darkness, thinks that their opinions, their point of view, they are the end in and of itself, and does everything to serve themselves to the point of Haman, which is utter megalomania, that nothing matters besides me being recognized as the one and only all-powerful, total subjectivity, total self-service, to that extent, that will still become a Gilui Shechina. In other words, why are we saying this? Because we have a major philosophical problem at the core of all our theology. This is a major problem that all the Balei Machshava deal with, which is, we've spoken about the parts of this. The only way a human being can exist with Bechira Chafshis is if Hashem is concealed, right? Familiar idea we've been speaking about? The greater the concealment, the greater HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Hashem's presence is not revealed, in other words, not overwhelming the person, the more person feels autonomous and has ability to make their own choices. Okay? So Hashem created the concealment. It's the nature of life. We call it darkness. Hashem created the darkness. So in the darkness, a person feels separate from Hashem, feels that they have their own free choice. Well, that can go haywire, as you see it does. The person can get so caught up in that belief, so disconnected from the reason that they have free choice, which is on their own to draw that R back into their lives and illuminate not just their lives but everyone around them. A person can disconnect from that, from the basic understanding of why they are autonomous and why there is an ani and why there is a self that feels so individual, and begin to believe that a person is an ends in and of themselves and get lost in the darkness. But then we have a question. But then Hashem will punish them for it? He created the darkness. He created the possibility to get lost in the darkness. In fact, Purim, Esther, Haster, Aster, Panai. So that means, why is there a double lashon? I will hide my face, I will be concealed, and I will conceal that I'm concealing my face. So a person is born into the darkness, gets lost in the darkness, and then gets punished for it? It's not acceptable. It doesn't work. There has to be something else going on. So what we know here is if the whole world is for chesed, and the whole world is so we become the ones who reveal HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this world, it can't be that a person gets lost in the darkness and gets punished for it, destroyed for it. There's something missing. So now we're seeing through the concept of nekama, which has a whole different meaning of what we're used to thinking about it, that no one ever gets lost. The biggest rasha doesn't get lost. Through the implosion of their own wickedness, they become a ultimate vehicle for Giloy Shemayim, for Giloy Kavod Shemayim, the revelation of Hashem's Kavod. Because through the fact that their evil destroys itself, that proves that there really is only a derech in one way, and everything else is imagination, it's fallacy. But we don't want to learn it that way. We want to learn it the pleasant way. But make no mistake about it, even Nebuchadnezzar, when you have a person who, out of desperation, commits suicide, let's say, right? They got they were lost, they were hopeless. That itself is a Giloy Shechina in the big picture, not in our little lives, not in our little lives, but nobody's here for their little lives, for their few physical years. We all live before and after and beyond. we don't see beyond it, but we all have an existence that precedes and follows our physical existence. And the person who can't live anymore, who can't live, is a lesson and a message that if there's no sense of tachlis, purpose, if their life is not illuminated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu's purpose for them and they don't feel they're fulfilling that role, they can't live. That itself is the same. It's a Gila Shechina. It represents there's only one truth, and it might as well learn it and figure it out, but not the unpleasant way. But even a pleasant person who suffers terribly because of the lack of the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in their life, they themselves are a vehicle. They're the Mikdash. They're a different form of the Mikdash. Every Jew who died al Kiddush Hashem, and we don't get to see the Nekama yet of the perpetrators of the evil, we haven't seen the Nekama yet. Nekama is not when the Allies bomb Berlin to smithereens. That's just punishing the perpetrator. That is not Nekama of Hashem, where the evil itself destroys itself. But we learn in Daniel that HaKadosh Baruch Hu awakens all the Rishayim in Tchiyas HaMesim to give them their real Nekama, to show them that their own rishus is what's destroying them, and then they become, in believe it or not, a form, one form or another, a type of a mikdash. They also become part of the Gilui Shechina. Nobody cannot be. What we're saying here is va'asuli mikdash. One way or another, a person is going to sanctify Hashem's name through their good choices or their bad choices. Vishachanti b'sochan, and Hashem's presence will be seen to dwell in them, good or bad. We obviously want to go the good route, the route of the mikdash, the right proper mikdash. But again, there's nobody that is lost and doesn't play a role in the ultimate revelation of why Hashem created us, why He gave us Bechira Chavshis, why He concealed everything. Either way, every person builds a mikdash on their own back, so to speak. We want to see in this world the nekama against the people that try to vie. We want to see the evil implode upon them. We would like to see, for example, this would be a Purim Nes. We would like to see that Iran, who we're so afraid of with their nuclear bomb, right? They actually managed to complete it. They launch it off, Chas v'Shalom, towards Israel. But because of somebody in the computer program who was busy texting his girlfriend instead of watching the computer, there's a little mistake, and it explodes on them. So Israel does nothing. We watch this. That would be a Purim miracle. By the way, it happened last week in a small scale. Do you know that Eretz Yisrael, Israel, secretly, has been blowing up nuclear scientists in Iran for the last year, correct? Everybody knows this. So they have this little bomb that they've created, that they drive up in a little moped, a motorcycle, they just stick it on the back of the car where the scientist that they're targeting is driving in, and 5 seconds later it explodes. So Iran decided they're going to do the same thing. You heard about this? So in Thailand, there was a bunch of bomb makers building this bomb, and the government, you know, the authorities were trying to find them, trying to close in on them. In the process of building the bomb, the house that they were in blew up. So they ran out, and there were authorities somehow closing in on them. So one had a grenade, and he threw it at the cop or whatever, the police or whatever it was. It hit a tree, bounced back, blew off his legs, and they captured him and got all the information on the whole network of Iranian terrorists down there. Okay? That is a Purim Nes. That's the way it should be. We just watch it, and it's very, very pleasant to watch. So that is, that's much, you know, nekama is very satisfying, but it's a much more satisfying nekama than getting a chance to rip your enemy to shreds. That's not so satisfying. First of all, nothing you do is enough. And secondly, you don't really want to be that person. It's just not really satisfying. Satisfaction is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu's nekama. So one way or another, there will be a mikdash built off every person. We just don't want it to be, obviously, the wrong way. So what we're doing now is we're going to look into the kalim that are mentioned in this week's parsha. We have a few weeks now of parshas of the Mishkan, so we'll have a lot of time to develop this. We're going to look into the kalim that are discussed in this week's parsha. That's the Aron, which we're not going to spend so much time on yet. We're going to actually do it more towards the end. But we're going to look into the Shulchan and the Menorah. Okay, now. The question is, we started out with saying like this, everyone will be a mikdash. Everyone will be a place for the Shekhinah to dwell, somehow or another. What makes the difference between how a person is going to be a mikdash? To what extent they get lost in the darkness and begin to see the ani as an end in and of itself, and then start to have, from their own point of view, objectives which are about them and their power and their mastery and their becoming God? Or a person is privileged and puts in the effort to recognize what the ani is all about, and recognizes that a person is meant to be a keli, a vessel, and use all of their personality and their individuality and their particular talents to draw down some of that aura into the darkness through the mitzvahs, through behaviors, as we spoke about, mishpatim, through knowledge, and spread it. To what degree a person, it's just the cognitive shift. What is the ani? The ani that's about myself leads to the giloy shechina through the nekama. The ani that's proper leads to the Gilui Shechina through building a real mikdash. It's all about that. So you're going to see, this is Rav Hirsch. Unbelievable. Rav Sham Shofal Hirsch on the mikdash. Everything about the Kalim and the Beis HaMikdash are going to be about the proper orientation to the Ani, to who I am. First of all, the Mesha Chachma says that, and you can plug this into all the things we spoke about by the Eitz Hadas and all that, because the Chet HaEgel is about same themes as the Eitz Hadas. We'll talk about it when we get to Chet HaEgel, but it's the same themes, which is going from objective, seeing myself correctly as a keli, to going to subjective, where it's all about me. That's really the theme. The Mesha Chachma says that prior to the Chet, every human being was capable of being a Mishkan for Hashem. They didn't need a central location. Each person could be a dwelling place for the divine. But after the Chet, we needed a low centralized place where everybody as a tzibur joins together and thereby brings down the Shekhinah to this world and has a place to do the avoda, a centralized location. It went from the individual being able to do it themselves to an individual needing a tzibur. What changed? The chait in the middle. The chait in the middle emphasized the I. And when the I becomes an end in and of itself, then I can't be a dwelling place for Hashem. So what fixes that? The recognition that you cannot function without a tzibur. You're not an I, you're part of the tzibur. The tzibur collectively serves Hashem. And when you're forced to be in a tzibur, you're forced to balance your sense of self. You have obligations to the tzibur. The tzibur demands from you. It's not just about me. The being in the tzibur, as opposed to living in your own world of your me, myself, and I, that's going to take the person back to a better place. Notice, by the way, women never form a tzibur. You could have 100 women together, they're not a tzibur. They don't have a minion of 10 or whatever. Women were not in the Chet HaEgel. Women never went through that transition from the yachid needing the tzibur. Women are always yachidim. They can be yachidim. They can daven as a yachid, do mitzvahs as a yachid. It's interesting. Men now work within the framework of a tzibur. It's a beautiful idea from the Mesha Chachma. So what is that saying? That's saying that that's the tikkun. That's the process whereby you don't dwell so much. You can't. It's harder to consider yourself the center of all things. And the kalim in the mikdash are about this. We'll start with the shulchan. The shulchan was a very odd-looking table. First of all, it was made of gold, wood, overlaid with gold. Rav Hirsch explains, whenever you're working with a keli that's made out of wood, wood is growing, accomplishment, development, constant movement, it's constant achieving. So first of all, the shulchan represents material, everything, bread, sustenance, everything in our lives, the physical that we do, that we are engaged in, that becomes part of our lives, necessary to survive physically, sustain ourselves, gratify ourselves, the pleasure of living, the pleasure of gratification, physical things, objects, food, clothing, shelter, everything material, that's represented by the shulchan. The shulchan, let's start like this, had in it bread, very odd-looking bread, and not just bread, also one of the ingredients of the ketores, levona, frankincense. Okay. Anyone know what that is in real life? I meant to look it up. I'll look it up later. A spice. Okay. Now, the shulchan was a very odd-looking thing. There were 12 slots for bread, the bread. The bread did not look like a loaf. It had a flat bottom and two sides. It looked like a U. And each of the sides had the width that almost equaled the total width of the bottom piece. Some say it equaled it completely or just about. Each bread, okay, was holding up, literally holding up the bread, the tray of bread on top of it. Six on one side, six on the other. Okay? Each loaf of bread literally supported on two sides the base of the loaf in front of it. Not only was each loaf of bread built where that it was not just a flat piece, but it had two arms, so to speak, holding up the one above it and being held up by the one below it. There were two sides, six and six. Everything was double. Each loaf was two isronim, okay, two measures, not one for one. We know that one isaron is considered like the same as an omer, enough to satisfy one person for one day. Each loaf of bread had two, me, obviously, and someone else. The pairs of bread were baked together, and pairs of bread were arranged together, two, 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 two. Everything was in pairs. The word shulchan is from the Shorah sholeach, to give out, to send forth, like shalach manos, to give to someone else. In other words, the core idea of the shulchan, of our pursuit of the material in this world, and don't forget, it wasn't just bread, there was levona, a spice, pleasant aroma, which means pleasure, was added to it, which means that satisfaction, a pleasurable thing, physical achievement in the world of the material, food, clothing, and shelter, has two aspects to it. It is a form of, we're supposed to derive pleasure for it. Hashem made satisfying our physical urges pleasurable. They're supposed to give us pleasure. It's a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that doesn't preclude us using them correctly. The theme of the Shulchan is everybody's acquisition or achievement in material supports the other, the next one, is part of the next one. What I achieve is part of your achievement. My bread supports your bread. Everything is in pairs, baked in pairs, arranged in pairs, two esronim per loaf, one for me and one for you. There's no such thing as acquiring for the sake of myself alone at your expense. It's always going to be at your expense. This brings up the different approaches of, by the way, Esav, Amalek, and Yaakov to material achievement, okay, to pursuing the material. Esav, the grandfather of Amalek, says, Yesh li rab, I have a lot. Yaakov says, Yesh li kol. Now, there is no way Yaakov had kol. Kol means everything. He had everything. He had all the clothing in the whole wide world, every animal that existed, the stars and the sun. He had everything. Of course he didn't have everything. When Esav said rav, it's honest. He had a lot, harbe. Here's the difference. HaKadosh Baruch Hu put us in a material world. There is no question that we are identified somehow with the things we acquire, our clothing, our food, our shelter, everything. The only difference is, again, going back to the ani, right? If I'm seeking an identity and a sense of a feeling that the I is everything, and I want to establish it and secure it like Haman and make it permanent and make myself feel that I, the ani, which comes from the Tzelem Elokim, has a life in and of itself, right? But it starts with me. It starts with my awareness of myself. And I want to establish that more and more, I pull in more and more things. So I have this object, so I'm more. I have this status, so I'm more. I'm known, I'm the skinniest, I'm the richest, I'm the prettiest, I'm the biggest, mitzvah girl. I do it's about me establishing my identity through objects. They give me an identity, and I need more and more and more to increase my identity. Because we always are increasing, like the shulchan, the wood, always growing. There's a natural drive in a person to always expand and always increase and become more and more and more. So there's one way, which is start with the concept that there's an I, period, end all, be all, and more defines me. Then you need more and more. You never stop till you get to Haman, and nothing's enough. Even if the entire world bows to you and one doesn't, you're not happy. That's with Mordechai, right? The other option is Yesh li kol. You all know what kol is. Keli, tachlis, Kalsa nafshi, a sense of yearning to be something. Where does the yearning come from? We know where it comes from. We said Hashem concealed himself, but we feel that something's missing, right? We know something's missing. We know there was this great, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence really pervades everything, but he concealed it, so we should be free. We sense what's missing, and we yearn for it, so we want to become a Keli. Therefore, anything we have, no matter what, the more or less, becomes a vehicle, a device, for us to bring through that object, through our clothing, through our homes, through our furniture, through our physical objects, through our achievements in all levels. It all becomes a keli to bring the truth, right, to not only to us, but to others beyond us. We become a vehicle. So we give our stuff an identity. As opposed to our things giving us an identity, we give our things an identity. We make them of use in spreading and increasing the awareness of Hashem in the world. Each thing becomes an opportunity. Everything's an opportunity. And the more that a person has opportunities, the better it is. The word kol is also the shorish of the word klal. Kolel, including everything, the klal, the group, the whole community. So our pursuit of material has to function under this premise. Anything I acquire for myself alone so that I can be greater is at your expense. It has to be that way. Status, reputation, that's where all Lashon Hara comes from, competition in owning things. But if I'm the source of an identity, and if I'm the source of the identity of my things, in other words, I make them be vehicles, I use them, and it's all about how I can take what I have and expand it further, then nobody is in competition with me. I am giving, I'm constantly giving, and I still can achieve more and more and acquire more and more and work for more and more, because the more I have, the more I can be a vessel to give more. So it doesn't mean an end of achievement. By the way, very important here to mention this. Ezo asher sumech b'chelko. It doesn't mean the chelik is never going to be something that a person has the wherewithal to achieve. That can never be a chelik. Like, I'm happy with my chelik. I did enough mitzvahs. I'm rich. I'm happy. I'm satisfied. I learned enough Torah. I'm satisfied. I gave enough tzedakah. I'm done. I had enough. I did enough for the community. I'm done. We don't have such a concept. Anytime a person has an opportunity to do more that of what could be done, you're never supposed to be satisfied. So what is the chelek that we're supposed to be satisfied with? You can't say, I have enough money, I'm done. That's not true. There's always more money, more opportunities, more mitzvahs, more influence. When are we ever supposed to be satisfied? With what? So the chelek is this and this only. The chelek is those conditions that the Kadosh Baruch Hu has given to us that we have no ability to interfere with, we have no say in the matter at all. Actually, for example, who our parents are, what generation we're born into, what we've been exposed to, the influences on us, everything we were nurtured with, our nature. What we've been given, everybody's different. That's our chelek. That's once we have our chelek, we have to be happy, then we take it, and then there is no end. There's no semech b'chelko after that. After that, you keep going and going and going, because everything's a keli. That's why Avraham got married at the end of his life, when he was done. It says, Vashem berach has Avraham bakol. The Ishbitzer says, what is kol? The need to keep going, and he married Keturah, Ketores, by the way. We'll talk about that. And had more children. There's never an end. Okay. So the concept of the shulchan, sholeach, sending out, supporting, pairs, mine, me, the individual and the tzibur, that functions together. That establishes the ani of a person in a proper perspective. There is a very strong individuality, but it has a purpose. It's not an end in and of itself. And that's the first, the basic lesson of the shulchan. And that allows a person orienting themselves that way it's possible that a person's physical life and everything they achieve and acquire in this world becomes a mikdash that's used correctly. It's mukdash, it's holy. In other words, it's elevated, it's transcendent, it's mufrash, it's separated. Becomes a way of sanctifying Hashem's name properly. The other thing, looking at materialism the wrong way, becoming a vacuum for it, wanting everything, means that it's going to be definitely at an innocent person's expense somehow or another. It's going to create a sense of discord and disconnect between people, and that rishus, that ultimately leads to wickedness. It can, and that will implode and destroy itself, and there'll still be a Giloy Shechina, but the wrong way. I mean, not the way we would prefer it to be. Now, the next thing is the menorah. So the Shulchan represents the material, right, the physical, and there's pleasure of that. Satisfying those needs is a great pleasure. That's why there's Lavona inside with the bread. As part of the avoda, but in the menorah also, the menorah represents the intellect, the knowledge of a person. Kiner mitzvah v'torah or. But what type of knowledge are we speaking about? Knowledge is not strictly intellectual. Gut knowledge, intuitive knowledge. We know that Rav Hirschsprung's endless psukim. I'm not going to quote them all to you, but endless psukim. Where it becomes clear that the type of intuitive knowledge we're speaking about here, as the menorah symbolizes, is also called the ruach of a person. Like Zechariah HaNavi was shown a menorah, and he said, what does it represent? And Hashem said, Lo b'chayil v'lo b'koach, not with might and force, ki im beruchi, it's showing you it's my ruach, my spirit. What is spirit? Ruach, wind, it moves. The spirit that moves a person. In fact, in terms of the Mishkan, we're going to see later that the Torah says, whoever's spirit moved him to donate to the Mishkan. Nadva libo, that his heart, he wanted to pledge to the Mishkan out of the sense of his spirit that moved him. Spirit, the ruach of a person, is the motivational force in a person, as we've called it, the drive, the initiative. The desire to make something out of, you know, of the raw material that we've been given. We just spoke about the Shulchan. That's the raw material. Objects, things, physicality. Now the desire to make something positive out of them. They can be used in many different ways. They can be used, if the spirit moves us, properly. But it depends what we want to make of them. Now we know that the ruach of a person associated with the neshama is a certain type of knowledge. Here is a basic dilemma, a thought, you know, a machshava, a question to think about. Again, Rav Moshe Shapira says this. We know that knowledge, increasing knowledge, there's a certain method to it. You can only increase knowledge based on knowledge that already exists. For example, if somebody says, E equals mc squared. It means nothing unless we start to think. Well, we know E is energy, and m is mass, and c is speed, and then we start. No, so we're working with notions we've already learned. What is energy? What is mass? What is speed? Etc. Or take like this: you have a musical score, a sheet of music. If a person has never seen it before, hasn't studied music, don't know what the notes are, it's nothing, it's zero. But a musician who knows what the notes mean and hears the music by looking at the page, gains knowledge, like new music based on previously established knowledge. So how do you start? You don't start by showing somebody a page of music if they've never been trained. First, you teach them what the notes are. Well, what a note is, random shapes. Well, first person has to know what a line is, a vertical line and a horizontal line. In other words, one piece of knowledge is built on the piece of knowledge prior to that. Here's the question. How does it start? A human being, a child, a baby, has no knowledge. They're tabula rasa. They don't know anything. Where does the first piece of knowledge attach itself to? That's the question. Where does the first piece of chachma attach itself to? Even today, anything you learn that can be an extension of something you already know becomes information that you can now work with. It expands what you already know. You get more pleasure out of it. You see have more understanding because of it, and you can expand it further because you're building on what you know. But where is the beginning? Where's the beginning? Observation. We can observe things that mean nothing to us. There has to be some piece of chokhma that's there that everything else then adds on to. Well, what's the first word a baby says? Right? Either ma, or no. But the first, one of the first words, okay, is, one of the first words is the first aspects of knowledge that we recognize in a baby is when a baby begins to understand and make it clear that they want something or don't want something. In other words, what precedes everything is a sense of I exist. There's an I. And when as soon as the baby starts to realize you are not me, he can call you mama or dada, right? That you're not me. The first element of knowledge that exists in every person intuitively is the ani. We're back to the ani, right? That, as a person grows, expands and expands and expands. It's meant to expand as far and wide as it possibly could. However, in a child, you see this. Every object becomes part of the ani, right? It's hard to take a toy away from the child. Everybody is part of the ani. Mine, they expect everyone to do what they want. In the beginning, the ani is the only thing we know, and every other piece of knowledge is absorbed into it, right? That's how it starts. But we're meant to get to a point, transfer that, where although the ani is the essential piece of knowledge of knowing, and that's the ruach, the spirit in a person that knows that there's an existence called an ani, it's tzelem Elokim, and that it wants something. That's the first piece of knowledge we have. What's supposed to happen is we get beyond our childish assumptions that everything becomes part of me, and therefore they're me and I own them, and they define me. We start to let that go, and as we said, we become, the ani becomes the definition, to the extent that the ani becomes a keli, and then it defines everything else around it, as we just spoke about with the shulchan. What you have in the menorah is a central trunk, one stem. That's the core. Out of this one stem comes six branches, one and six. You know what we're talking about. All of teva, all of nature, is the 6 days of creation. In other words, our sense of self expands to expand into the teva, into nature, into life. But we invest it with meaning coming from us. It doesn't invest us with meaning. And then all the lamps, all the flames, all faced back inwards to the center lamp, which means you start with an awareness and all chachma, because the menorah is chachma, but the intuitive chachma that leads to all the other chachma. Because as we say, reishis chachma yiras Hashem. If you don't start with the core of truth, of knowledge, of yourself, of your purpose, of that there is an ani, all the chachma you learn and acquire and increase will bring you far away into realms that are irrational and untrue. If the chachma is not centered back at this truth, in other words, all the chachma that we strive to increase for ourselves, that the chachma that drives us and motivates us, the chachma that helps us to expand into the world and use it, has to have at its core the constant notion that it started with, that there is an ani, and the chachma is meant to enlighten that and be focused back on that, but the ani as the source of enlightenment, not as the ani that's drawing it in. Remember the windows in the base of Mikdash? Because of the light of the menorah, the windows in the base of Mikdash were very, very narrow on the inside and wide on the outside. But there were no electric lights or other lamps in the Beis HaMikdash. So you would expect it to be very, very narrow on the outside and wide in the inside. So the light that comes in would be expanded or diffracted in all directions, the opposite. So they explained that the light of the menorah is what expanded out to Yerushalayim, out to Eretz Yisrael, out to the world. So that it moves from starting at the central core, but properly oriented back to it. So it never becomes we don't start to go in all kinds of directions with our inquiry and our increasing of knowledge that takes us away from the concept that the ani that Hashem created is for a purpose to enlighten and not to absorb everything into itself. So the menorah itself again represents the idea that not only in the material pursuits, but in the intellectual, which allows us to discover the world and draw from the world the enormous potential in this world, with our intelligence, to expand our intelligence in all directions of the six, the Sheishas Yimei Bereishis, the Teva that Hashem created, to fill it with our Chachma, to learn from it, to utilize it, to take advantage of it. There is so much chokhmah to be had, and all of it at the service, helping us to recognize the center core, the center truth, the Tzelem Elokim, the purpose Hashem put us here for, and not to take us way off track and allow us to confuse ourselves and think that and use our mind to fool ourselves that it's all, you know, that there's endless opportunities to increase the self for the sake of self. We gave a mashal for this. The mind is nimshal to a mirror. There are two things, we're going to give two examples of what you could do with the mirror. You could put mirrors on all your walls, let's say in the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles, and then what do you see? Yourself. And everything that you've accumulated in your room, how many times do you see it? Infinitely, from a million different angles. And that's all you keep seeing is you and your thoughts and your point of view and what you have, you know, what you know over and over and over again. When a person's mind, the pursuit of the of chachma is in that type of a room, and the mind becomes that kind of a mirror, what happens is a person has the mind is a powerful device, is meant to do a job, but it becomes trapped. And all it does for us, if we are the center of all things, well, and our mind becomes a closed door, so to speak, a room we're trapped in. Our mind only gives us information and rationalizations and strategies and explanations that are like bouncing back on what we already know and our point of view and what we want to know and our limitations. It's nothing but our own limitations coming back at us. And the mind doesn't expand, and then we see only ourselves. And we bring ourselves more excuses and ways and strategies to increase ourselves, and all we see is ourselves, bouncing back at ourselves all the time. But you could take that mirror, right, that's the mind, put it in a telescope, like the Hubble telescope, and then what do you get to see with your mind? The outer space, all the galaxies, a whole huge world beyond me. And that brings me real chokhmah. And that allows me to think of going, you know, of understanding things I don't understand yet, seeing things from a different perspective. That brings me a much bigger reality than myself, and I'm past myself. So the menorah starts with a sense of the value, the purpose, the trunk, the core of the echad, the one HaKadosh Baruch Hu invested, the kochos invested in one person. Then a person's with intellect, light, ha'ara sinayim, that's light, and motivation, taking the chachma, but motivated to use it, not for the self, but for the self becoming the vehicle it's supposed to become. That's the menorah. All the aron is mentioned in this parsha. We're not going to discuss it right now, but and we have it. And this parsha doesn't talk about the mizbeach haketoras, so that's for later. But these two, I just want to end with this idea. These two, the intelligence and the so to know the proper orientation of the ani and the support and infrastructure of the community that one is part of the other. These two, both of these kelim, by the way, the shulchan and the menorah. One is made out of a tree, that's the shulchan, and one is made out of pure gold. The difference is that the shulchan is expanding all the time, in other words, there's no end, but the menorah is pure gold, which means it must be consistent 100% of the time. It must be solid and pure 100% of the time, meaning it has to, no mistake can creep in. There is no room for error in this area. It must always be pure. Once the mind deviates the slightest bit, it's off. It's way off. It must be remain consistently aware of this focus, and then there's growth, but the growth that's very contained. So these two things are the beginning of our discussion of the Mishkan, and keep these in mind because we're going to build on this. Now, before we end, two announcements. The Young Israel is making a dinner. We always do a collective ad from the group. Here is an envelope. Here's the ad. Please, before you go, put a little check in the envelope. Also, Anita Corin right here has a beautiful business selling pearls. Read this that she gave out to you. I'm sure you'll be happy to know what she does. It'll be of benefit. Have a wonderful week, everyone, a good Rosh Chodesh, and you will, Amir Hashem, be zocha to see the Nisim this month, the Nisim of La'asid Lavo.